structural integrity is holding.
Barry, what you're seeing is the Speed Force. Your past, your present, your future, all at once. So you need to focus on where you want to go. So think about that night. Think about your mother.
Welcome to the fourth episode of Zero Hour Strikes, the show that covers DC's 1994 crossover event, Zero Hour Crisis in Time. Every issue, every tie-in, every zero issue. I'm Siskoid.
I'm Bass.
And in this episode, we take a look at Green Lantern number 54 and Flash number 94, both occurring just prior to the first issue of Zero Hour. And Bass, I know you're a big fan of these characters.
Yes, I am.
Well, Wally West, Kyle Rayner.
All of them. And Alan Scott's in this.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so we'll get a chance to talk about our fandoms for at least this version of Green Lantern, because he wasn't around in Invasion.
Exactly.
And Wally's changed a lot as well in the 5 years since the our other show's focus.
Became Sentinel at one point.
I
don't even know what that is, but he became Sentinel.
I'll have answers.
Okay.
So let's start with the Green Lantern issue.
Yeah.
So where was Green Lantern in 1994? As will be very clear from this issue we're covering, Kyle has just become Green Lantern. As most listeners will know, Hal Jordan went mad after the destruction of Coast City by Mongol during the reign of the Superman, ended up destroying the Green Lantern Corps, and only one ring apparently survived, which was gifted to comic book artist Kyle Rayner by the last Guardian of the Universe, Ganthet. That happened in issue 50, only 4 issues before Zero Hour. So we're very, very early in his career.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what's going on.
It's a nice way to introduce Kyle Rayner to everybody by getting him inside a crossover. So that's a great way to get him known name out there.
And that's why we get sort of a recap of what has gone before.
Yeah.
So that we, the audience that is just picking up this one issue.
Yeah, we know what's going on.
Okay, I wasn't following Green Lantern, but this is the new status quo. And this is what's gone before that I maybe missed. And for Kyle, it's new information as well. So there's a plot reason why we get this massive info dump in the middle of the issue. Let's go into the synopsis. And then we can talk about the comic itself. Green Lantern number 54 by Ron Mars, Daryl Banks, Derek O'Coin. I'm going to use the French version of that name. I have no idea.
O'Coin,
but I mean, it's a Quebecer name.
Yeah,
it's so, O'Coin. Romeo Tangal and Craig Hamilton. There's a lot of artists on this one. It's called Assault and Battery. Pretty simple, actually. Kyle is fighting Major Force, who just recently and very famously killed his girlfriend, Alex. The fight is brutal, and Kyle finds his ring can run out of power for the first time. Before Major Force kills him and takes the ring back to his government masters, the monster asks what this lump of green ore he found in the alley where Kyle found the ring is. It's a mistake, because that rock suddenly becomes a lantern and recharges Kyle's ring. Our new GL manages to defeat Force this time, but the LA Special Crimes Unit shows up to take him into custody. Before Kyle can get his revenge, overcome with grief, Kyle flies off to be alone, but is intercepted by Alan Scott, the Golden Age Green Lantern, who tells him about his legacy and gives him words of encouragement. Kyle makes a vow to honor Alex by facing up to his responsibilities of being a hero. Just in time, it seems, because Superman and Metron show up to recruit him for the event. So, I mean, he's just put on the suit and already...
he's going in.
DC's going down.
Yeah. First line of defense, Kyle Rayner. Get in there, son.
This is, for many readers, maybe the first introduction to this character.
Yeah, and how evil Major Force is.
Oh, God.
He's horrible.
We don't see the fridging here, but of course, that's the famous death of Alex. That spawned a meme, I guess, fridging female characters, or characters that are only there to be killed and killed horribly so that the hero then has motive.
Yeah, that's horrible.
So, of course, this has existed forever. Uncle Ben, Bruce Wayne's parents. But in this case, it's when we talk about something that's gratuitous, where Alex is actually a positive force in Kyle's life. She's the one that's telling him to face up to the responsibility of the ring. She's in on it. You think this is going to be an interesting dynamic. And then she's killed for no other reason than to make Kyle react, basically.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, we'll talk about Flash later, which is basically Hunter Zolomon's motive when he takes on Wally West the Flash. He tries to kill, Linda all the time just to make Flash better, and it never works.
Right.
So they tried to unfridge the fridgings within the Flash things, but, you know, it's too easy.
And in the case of when you do it to a female character to motivate a male character,
it's horrible.
It's sexist, it's misogynistic.
It's horrible.
And this is what really put Gail Simone on the map, I guess, because she took part in that website that was tracking these things. She was one of the writers on that blog. I'm going to call it a blog. But she was one of the writers there, came to some notoriety, got a chance to write comics, and I think that's how she started out. So
I did not know that.
So before the Secret Six, before Birds of Prey.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but it all starts here, really, because this is the, I guess, the moment where some people said, enough is enough. Yeah. This is too much.
1994. Hole had a number one album, I think. You should learn how to say no! Ladies were coming out of their shell. That was enough. Good job, ladies.
So this isn't in this issue, but I remember seeing it. I did pick up the beginning of... Actually, I was reading Green Lantern all the way through.
Okay.
And then I dropped out somewhere in the Kyle Rayner run, but I was reading up to this point.
Yeah, I kind of know that because I think these comics exist in your
boxes. Yeah, they're in boxes.
Because I read them. I read them at your place.
There you go.
Like 15 years ago.
So what do you think of the... Let's start with the art, because there are three artists here. They're not all of the same style, even.
Yeah.
There's a very 90s vibe to at least the Daryl Banks, who does the cover, who does a part of the story, like the fight. That's all Daryl Banks. That's a very 90s...
Very.
Gooey spit.
Yeah.
Kind of extreme physiques kind
yeah.
of art.
Yeah. It's, well, the art is a bit inconsistent, I'd say. There are some nice elements to it, I'd say. I'm trying to think of, because it's not an ugly issue. It's just all over the place. There are some bits that I kind of liked. You know, the noir aspect when Alan Scott comes into the apartment.
Yeah, that's like the Derek Oakland stuff that I find is much stronger.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's like a silent, more or less silent page where Kyle goes down into this disused warehouse or something. Yeah. And it's like we see his grief. There's strong expressions. They just black him out. Like he's just a silhouette. But but the tears are, you know, white and you can see them. These are strong images, I think.
Yeah.
So I like this sort of rounded, soft art.
Yeah. Yeah,
much better than the rest.
Yeah, the fight sequences are very 90s.
Yeah, pretty violent.
Very much so.
There is a point where Kyle creates an electric chair to zap Major Force with.
That was kind of extreme, but that's the word of the 90s, extreme. And Major Force is just being a psychopath. Completely just enjoying killing a lady for no reason. You know, she's just in there. So it's, the dialogue was rough. The artwork, the fight sequences were very much extreme.
And then there's the Craig Hamilton stuff. So people will know, people from the network will know Craig Hamilton as the artist of the 1980s Aquaman miniseries. So all of that very intricate layout. And it's just for the recaps. He's just doing the memories sort of thing. So yeah, he's putting a lot of stuff in.
These splash pages are delightful. They're intricate. There's a lot of stuff. You can just sit there and look at them for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Just to look at stuff.
The history of Hal Jordan. Yeah, the history of...
Because the history is... You go through it very quickly. I mean, the synopsis, like you synopsis. You know, four sentences and we're done.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, the storytelling within these splash pages are great. I really enjoyed that.
Because he goes above and beyond and he's drawing like the entire Green Lantern core.
Yeah.
So you're spotting actual characters in the background. I mean, everybody's colored. I mean, there's no washes here. It's
exactly.
Just like, and it's very geometrical. So he does these things where you're looking at like a gemstone or a kaleidoscope kind of page.
Yeah, and how it's built in this V-type shape. You know, you see the descent of Hal Jordan and his growth in power in the other side, in the dark side.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, when he's, like, where he's got his shirt ripped.
Yeah.
It's like the layout is built around just, like, these green streaks.
Yeah.
But it really feels like, the way it looks, it's like things are falling from the sky.
Exactly.
It's like the core is being destroyed.
Yeah, everything's broken.
Yeah. Even though it's just supposed to be like lights, it's supposed to be like a lens flare. That's what it is. That's the kind of feeling it gives. So in between the light streaks, you've got like different, you've got the panels, I guess.
Yeah.
And it takes us right through to like the new costume where he's a villain and all of that stuff.
Over intricate costume.
Mm.
The era. The parallax costume.
Yeah, the parallax costume. It's that era. So that's the art. I mean, it keeps switching.
To be fair, the fight sequences are made by somebody, I think, who loves fight sequences.
Sure.
I think the darker and more moody things are done by somebody who likes dark and moody. And the intricate panels are done by somebody who does it very well. So every part kind of looks good on its own.
So from the editing standpoint, when they found out they couldn't reach their deadline, yeah. I guess.
At least
with one artist.
They got people who know what they're doing and are good at what they're doing. So at least that's what I felt when I was looking at it. But bunched together, you kind of feel like you're reading three comics. Mm. Or, you know, you have sometimes you have like these, like in the trade paperbacks or something, you have like four pages of another comic that was in something else, but it's relevant to this story. So it's in the, you had kind of that feel where, you know, the art style is switching and the colors are switching, but hey, it's the same story. So you roll with it. That's how it kind of felt. But, you know.
Let's end the story we're telling, which is the Major Force story. And then, well, we gotta get into this 0 hour thing. Is there much 0 hour in this?
Not much. Not much. I think, I'm not even sure where.
I mean, the end, obviously, when...
Yeah, Superman comes in. But, I mean, this feels like the start of Kyle Reiner's hero journey. I mean, he meets...
I was really questioning if the original Green Lantern's appearance was in some way a time travel element. It isn't.
It's not.
But I was looking, you know, I was actually trying to track his different costumes, because here he's got the one where there's a big lantern logo on his chest.
Yeah.
But when he's Sentinel, it's actually like a star motif.
Yeah.
So that's not it. So he's not yet Sentinel. Because if he were Sentinel, then he wouldn't be wearing the ring. Because as Sentinel, he had just like the green out of his hand.
Yeah, he was the ring.
He was the ring.
He had the I don't even know where the power comes from. The pulse star.
Yeah. Something so then like he's that. Like he's wearing the green, but you don't see the logo. They're always like kind of hiding his chest. So I was like, but the cape is green, where Alan Scott's cape is
purple.
But as Sentinel, he was green. But then there's this middle range where he appeared in Green Lantern Quarterly. And he had that costume that he's, I think, wearing there, even though... So I was like, and then he disappears in a swirl of light. Is he from another time? Is he from another reality? I kept asking those questions. He's not. This is happening. I guess he senses that somebody has the ring, that Kyle needs help. He's sort of introducing himself into the Green Lantern legacy.
He'll be part of this story arc, right? Because the old heroes, they're all in there.
Well, we'll see.
Because he becomes young again at some point. I only
he looks young again already.
Yeah, already, yeah.
So there are things happening to Alan Scott that are outside the... Because the Green Lantern books are so popular. So you got Green Lantern, you had Guy Gardner had his own series.
Yeah.
And the Quarterly is still going on, maybe? Or maybe not. No, maybe it's dead. Maybe Kyle is just like, you know, Guy Gardner is going to be Warrior and there's only going to be one Green Lantern, right? So you can't do a Quarterly. So I'm not entirely sure at this point.
When this
we'll
is
see if he comes back.
This is after the Sun Eater saga, right?
No. Final Night is after this.
Final Night is after this.
Yes. Yeah, because it's Hal Jordan's redemption.
Ah, okay, yeah.
So it's not. It's not a time travel or time anomaly. But it's still thematically consistent with it because we're getting two versions of Green Lantern meeting, the earliest one and then the latest one. We're still getting...
The legacy
element. He still comes out of nowhere and goes back to nowhere. So it's not a time travel thing, but at least Ron Mars is doing a riff on that. It's going to have the same feeling as other tie-ins, even though he's not actually using time travel. So that's how I reconciled it inside myself. Because really, it's got the 0 hour logo, and it's just because Kyle gets recruited at the end.
Yeah, because Mullet, Superman, and Metron come over. That's basically it.
Yeah. My favorite bit of that is that Kyle sees Metron's chair. It's his cool chair.
Yeah.
And so he has, as a comic book artist himself, he has an appreciation for Kirby Tech.
Yeah.
And it's also green.
It's very green. It's very green.
So it looks like something that he might have constructed. The Mobius chair. I like it.
Maybe they were thinking of linking the Green Lantern Corps or the battery or, you know, that kind of primal power to the chair. Maybe.
I know you like Alan Scott.
I like
Alan
Scott.
Even though we're not sure where he is in his timeline now.
I like the JSA.
But what about Kyle Rayner?
I was never a big fan of Hal Jordan. I always thought he was kind of, you know, boring. Not that he's not a great hero. I love him more than any Hawkman. But I never really you know, if I was to play superheroes when I was young, yeah, I would never, ever be Hal Jordan. You know, I'd be Kilowog. If I was to be a Green Lantern, I'd be anybody before I'd be Hal Jordan.
Chip.
I'd be Chip. Oh, I'd be Chip in a second. You know, I'd be Gnort.
Okay, you'd know. Be Gnort. Okay.
I'd be anybody. But not Hal Jordan. It's just that Hal to me was kind of this, you know, fly boy, cool kid, nice jacket. Has a ring. I don't know. He was kind of, yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, he's fine. Became evil. Yeah. Destroyed stuff. Killed a lot of people. So when we have this new kid, you know, he's not this plain white guy. I always liked that. He had this weird mask that I didn't like at first.
The crab.
Yeah. I didn't like it first. And then I thought, yeah, you know what? I can dig it. And I really liked how as soon as we got Kyle Rayner, from that point, we had people doing constructs differently. Hal Jordan was always like, you know, boxing gloves and baseball bats and baseball mitts. And all of a sudden, we have mechas. And we have like these overdrawn, big old constructs. And when the other Green Lantern come back and, you know, we see John Stewart coming back. Well, he was an architect, so everything is precise, everything is angled, everything. And all of a sudden, we see personality come out of the rings. Mm. And I really like that. And I think the tipping point for that was Kyle Rayner.
That's a good point. That's a good point. And he was, when you're reading Green Lantern, suddenly it's a big shift. And I'm not a big fan of Ron Mars as a writer. So, I mean, early on, there's the fridging incident, but it's not necessarily the only problem I might have with this writer's scripts. But as a character who then went on to be in the JLA, who then was written by other people as well, I ended up, I was, I don't know, lukewarm about Kyle, I guess, but I ended up liking him. And I liked the idea that it wasn't like, I'm a Green Lantern, here's my ring, or I'm, you know, I've been sore kind of thing. He just doesn't know what he's doing with it. And so he redesigns the costume. There's no core to emulate. So he's just making this stuff up as we go along. They jettison a bit much of it. I mean, you know, like he recharges the ring and he doesn't do the oath.
Yeah.
Because there's no oath. There's no core. Maybe they throw away the baby with the bathwater some instances where it doesn't feel at all like the mythology is gone. But Kyle has to create his own mythology. Is the problem, is the thing that he has to struggle with.
He's Luke Skywalker. We're not going to get into that.
He's a fourth baby. So, but yeah, you know, he's just this. Actually, he's more of a Rey as pictured in the first couple films.
Yeah,
at least a nobody.
Exactly. Just given this power and deal with it.
Yeah. So he's Spider-Man, really. He's a Marvelized DC character, where Green Lantern was a sort of chosen one kind of thing. Not Kyle. Kyle is struggling with it. He's got his Uncle Ben story, and he has to, you know, pay tribute to that, dedicate his life to something. But he's a nobody. So this is more of a Marvel hero angsty.
Very much so, yeah.
And in the 90s, they were really trying to push. Well, I say in the 90s, but it started in the 80s. You know, as soon as Marvel started doing better business than DC, DC started to try to emulate that success.
That's how you do it.
And Kyle was definitely, I think, like Firestorm is maybe the first Marvel hero at DC in the 70s, but Kyle was definitely in that vein.
I always liked the dynamics of Wally West and Kyle Rayner within the JLA.
Sure. The two legacy kids.
Yeah, two legacy kids who were, you know, basically a rekindling of Green Lantern, Hal, and Barry doing things together. You know, they're both hugely powerful heroes.
Well, they both, came out of Showcase.
Yeah.
They're the first Silver Age heroes.
And they were kids, well, young adults, within the Justice League. So they had this dynamics where they were intimidated by... Well, everybody's intimidated by Batman. I said the F word, sorry. Everybody's intimidated by Batman, but all of a sudden we have this story where Central Park becomes an enchanted forest. Remember that? And then they come on, they see Wonder Woman being in this casket type thing, and they have to kiss her so she'll wake up. Flash and Green Lantern, and this is Wally and Kyle going, all right, I can't kiss her. I'm not going to kiss her. You kiss her. And I'm not going to kiss her. What the hell are you talking about? And then Arthur comes along, Aquaman, and yeah, well, I'm a king. I'll kiss her without her consent. They have this dynamic where, you know, Batman touches Wally and he's like, oh my God, Batman just touched me. I'm going to die. So, you know, they have this thing where Justice League was also serious, but these two were goofballs and yet very powerful goofballs. And I really love that.
So I think he's redeemed. If you didn't like him or didn't like his costume, I think he is eventually redeemed. And eventually the costume, they do away with that costume. They bring back the core. And
yeah, I know. I did like that costume, though. I did like it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was one of those who I was like, yeah, you know what? The bodysuit, the Green Lantern bodysuit, I'm not digging it. I like John Stewart type suit better than the Al Jordan suit. I didn't really understand.
Yeah, but why. I like the way that they could all modify their costumes, their uniforms. But for Kyle, it's a little bit.
Yeah, it was
very off model.
Yeah, it was in left field. It was very off.
So this issue, not very 0 hour based, but gave us the chance to talk a bit about Kyle.
Yeah.
He's one of the new heroes of this era.
We didn't talk much about Alan Scott, though.
Well, go ahead.
I always thought he was this very charming superhero. For some odd reason, these superheroes, they didn't have very big personalities, but they had this swagger about them. It was like if Dean Martin was a superhero.
Ain't that a kick in the head?
He always had this little, they were too cool for school, so I always liked him. I really enjoyed that he's not part of the Green Lantern Corps as per se, that his power comes from somewhere else. And the way they do the constructs are always also very different. They kind of look a lot like, they always have these green flames around them, which is great. And they always kind of look like tattoos, like old school biker tattoos.
Okay.
And I kind of like that because they're weird. They're weird. And this one, he uses this to restrain Kyle. He uses this skeleton hand. I mean, would somebody use a skeleton hand? Just use a rope or something? But he uses this weird skeleton covered in flames.
I think he's really, they're pushing the mystical element. Yeah. Once you've got the science fiction Green Lantern Corps, then you're saying, Alan Scott, it's magic.
It's magic.
So maybe this is more like a mystical, and even his appearance. I mean, he shows up, he's like a Doctor Strange or if we keep it to DC, he's like a Phantom Stranger.
Yeah.
Kind of showing up and
Big collar,
telling him what's happening, mentoring, but then disappearing into
thing. He's basically Gandalf in this thing. Yeah. That's why, you know, this is where we're starting off with Kyle. So, and he was always a leader also within the JSA. He's leader type. So I really enjoyed that he came along, even if it's, you know, it's a bit Christmas carol-y. I kind of enjoyed seeing
it's
him.
It's a bit Christmas carol-y.
Yeah, he's like the Green Lantern of Christmas past. I mean, he's way up there. I mean,
that makes sense. All right. Where was The Flash in 1994?
Oh, The Flash was, I mean, he was starting off. He was, this was Mark Waid's, I think, first run.
It was actually, I think, like the third year. We're in the third year of Mark Waid.
We're just getting Impulse in this one, which is the Flash from the 30th century.
Yeah.
His cousin?
Nephew?
He's Barry's...
Well, let's see.
Grandson.
And he's Iris's grandson, and Iris is Wally's aunt.
Aunt.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's the...
So...
That's the cousinage here. Because between Invasion and 0 Hour... a lot has changed.
Yeah.
And it's not just, you know, the supporting cast. He's come into his own. He's learned more about the Speed Force.
Yeah.
Or he's learned about the Speed Force full stop. I mean, that wasn't a thing, the Speed Force. Yeah. And he harnessed it to give himself even more power than Barry Allen had. The stuff where giving momentum to other people or to other objects. He was, at this point, struggling with the phasing ability, like running through walls and they would explode.
Yeah.
So he could charge objects in a way. He's gotten into a defining relationship with Linda Park.
Yeah.
Since last time. And that's become the core of Mark Waid's run, really, is that love between Wally and Linda. It's still early stages here, I guess. And he's become also, talking about the cores, he's become the core of a super speedster community. So the book has included now Jay Garrick, Max Mercury, Johnny Quick, and very recently, yes, another speedster.
Impulse.
Impulse. Not yet called Impulse, I think. He's not wearing the mask yet.
He's not wearing the mask yet.
He's the son of one of the Tornado twins.
Oh, yeah.
So Iris and Barry are his grandparents. So they gave birth to the Tornado twins. The Tornado twins split off, had kids of their own. One of these couples had Impulse. One of the other couples, post 0 Hour, will have had Excess.
My favorite Legionnaire.
Excess does not yet exist at this point, pre 0 Hour. And he's been taken back in time to the 20th century by Iris to get his super metabolism under control. Because he's grown up. In 2 years, he's become a teenager. And he's lived in a virtual reality world.
Doesn't understand danger.
Exactly. So he's living this game because only the game could stimulate his brain at the same speed as he was growing up.
Welcome to Jumanji!
And I think they just got his metabolism under control. But that's it, you know.
But the brain is still going.
Yeah, yeah. He's, and
Mach 3.
At the same time, Linda's been investigating a terrorist the terrorist cult Cobra for a story, and she might not have made it out alive without the help of Bloodline's hero Argus. And that's going to be relevant. I mean, these seem like trivial details,
yeah,
but they are relevant to the issue that we're going to discuss.
Yeah, of course.
Argus. You're not an Argus fan?
Argus has big hair and a full-faced mask, and he's very, very, very 90.
He's one of the more successful
yeah.
Bloodlines heroes.
Yeah, I get it.
Because, but that bar's not high. Hitman went to series. That was a success. Argus got a miniseries, and he appeared here and there. And his name, Argus, has since become, in the New 52 and in the TV shows, Argus is like an organization. So they kept that name around. They kept that IP alive.
It's a great name.
Let's look at the issue itself before we discuss it. Splash number 94 by Mark Waid, Carlos Pacheco, Wayne Foucher, and Jose Marsan Jr. It's called Reckless Youth, Chapter 3. Just do it. Wally is struggling to keep up between Bart's running around the house, Iris seriously close to dropping future history knowledge, and his own jealousy about Argus keeping an eye on Linda, and Cobra goons threatening the people he cares about. Iris tells him she doesn't know as much about history as he thinks because she's detected a destructive force in the time stream that is literally changing time. They encountered it while coming to the 20th century, so there may be a little zero hour or wink even before this. Linda gets a tip from Argus that Cobra is hiding out in an old factory. Wally follows up and finds the factory is just a hologram covering a high-tech lair, complete with chemical labs and armories. All his stealth comes to naught when Bart comes rushing in and attacks the cultists. Because he has no sense of danger, like you said, Wally spends more time saving the kids' bacon than fighting Cobra. They follow the main guy, who is not Cobra. Cobra's not showing up here yet. But the main Cobra guy in Keystone City. They follow him into the holographics lab, but he's already dead, cut in half by a laser. It is Abracadabra's doing. Flash has recently defeated him in this region a few issues before, but he survived and hid in Cobra's secret operation, planning to take it away from the cult and use it to destroy the Flash. And now Wally's trapped in a web of lasers at Kadabra's mercy. There's no way out until Kadabra's costume starts to change into the old model, then into a new one, and it surprises him so much he drops his weapon. As the Flash jumps him, both suddenly find themselves in the 64th century, which is Kadabra's home time, and then Wave Rider shows up.
Whoa! In that classic Wave Rider fashion.
On a surfboard made of light. Zero Hour catches up to the characters at the end, so it's a bit like the Green Lantern one, where there's so much plot from what's been happening before, that there's no room for anything Zero Hour except the recruitment, maybe? So there's that blip at the end.
Yeah.
But still, Iris does say there's a force changing history.
So there's an anomaly in there somewhere. But there's also, theme-wise, there's also this thing about legacy. Mm-hmm. You know, we had the Green Lantern legacy highlighted in the Green Lantern issue. In this one, we have he's going to be the new sidekick, even if Flash says, I don't do sidekicks.
Well, actually, he's not going to be the new sidekick, is he? I mean,
no,
he's going to be like a young hero in that same group.
He's going to be living with Max, and
we see Max Mercury in this. He's just like skulking around the outside the window.
I didn't get that. I mean, Max would be welcome inside Wally's house any day, or would he? I don't know.
He's a mysterious, he's a man of mystery at
this
point.
He's a man of, and an awful costume. But, I kind of like the costume, actually.
Yeah, no, I like the Quicksilver costume.
Yeah, the Quicksilver.
That was his actual name.
Yeah, before it became Max Mercury for trademarks.
Before trademarks.
I mean, all that said, we do have this thing where we have a younger, non-experienced new hero and this older, very experienced hero. I mean, at this point, Wally was a superhero since he was like, 12?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Bart is more or less the same age as when Wally was Kid Flash.
And huge powers. Wally has been, he's a career superhero. He didn't go to plumbing school and became a superhero. He was always just a superhero. So he's this professional superhero, all of a sudden with this kid who has all this power and doesn't know what to do with it. So, there's this kind of parallel thing where Wally would be the, Alan Scott and Kyle and Bart would be the younger hero. So that's kind of there's this similar type thing going on, which is is great because 0 hour is all about time.
I mean, it makes sense for The Flash to be part of this.
Oh, well, yeah.
Traditionally, it kind of has to be because, yeah, The Flash has a relationship with a future.
Yeah.
I mean, Barry Allen went to hide out in the future. The Reverse Flash comes from the future. Abracadabra comes from the future. A lot of future villains.
A lot of future villains.
So
he has the only time machine.
That's right. The cosmic treadmill.
Yeah.
So there is a relationship with time. Flash has to be in this. Also,
and Speed has a great relationship with time. I mean,
In physics terms, yeah, for sure. And then there's also this is a crisis.
Yeah,
and Flash. I mean, at this point, we don't have that tradition necessarily that the Flash must be a defining character in any reboot. But Barry Allen was very important to Crisis on Infinite Earths. Will Wally become as important to 0 hour?
We're hoping.
That's what we want to happen. And as we'll see very soon, the first issue of 0 hour has the Flash's mask on it, on the cover. So,
yeah.
Okay, it's Crisis. And as we'll find out up through, I guess, Flashpoint. Flashpoint is all about the Flash making changes to the timeline somehow.
Yeah. So, horrible decisions.
But, I mean, it doesn't really...
Go home, bury your drunk. But
so a crisis, time travel, The Flash. I don't think this is as easy to grasp an issue. It's not a jumping on point the same way that the Green Lantern issue was.
No,
because
so.
There's so much going on. I mean, I was struggling. I've read these books and I was struggling to catch up. Where are we exactly? Who is it? You know, so somebody that would come in would go, whoa. You know.
Well, I went, whoa.
Okay.
I went, whoa.
And you've read these issues.
And I read these issues
before,
yeah, but I, you know, I was on the Cobra timeline.
Mm.
You know, I didn't really read 0 hour. They were outside of this other story. So I was like, what is this? It is confusing, but I was just excited to see Mark Waid on a Flash comic.
What about that new Abracadabra costume?
The one with the cards? It's horrible. It's horrendous.
Yeah, I would have dropped my weapon too. I was like, oh, yeah. What?
Why am I dressed like this?
There's a future version of me that's going to be wearing this? No.
What? I'm part of the Full House gang? What the hell?
Yeah, I like the old style where he's dressed as a magician.
Yeah, stage magician all the way.
But then at this point, he's wearing that sort of, I don't know, open V blouse.
The street magician from the 1990s.
Yeah, I guess that's an updated, if you look at Magic Acts.
Yeah, but he's disfigured also.
Oh, that's
I like the long mustache, you know, that long.
My dad had that mustache.
Oh, yeah, I love that. I love that. That's commitment to a mustache.
You gotta curl it.
You gotta curl it.
I mean, in the future, he's wearing like almost a helmet thing, and he looks like a member of the Royal Flush
Gang. The Royal Flush Gang.
Yeah.
I said Full House Gang. I don't know my
Full House Gang, yeah.
I don't know my poker.
Which one is it?
Or
it's Uncle Jesse.
He might be just like a goon, like one of Joker's goons.
Oh, yeah. I mean, now I think he's a little more, I don't know, he feels a little more snobbish to be just a goon.
Yeah, well, he's card trick man. No.
Yeah.
He's not Abracadabra.
No, it's not good. So hopefully this is an anomaly going forward for him.
I mean, it's normal. He dropped that laser like he would in real life. I mean, you have the laser, I have you, the Flash, and all of a sudden you look like a throw-up from playing cards or something. And
one of the things I do like, and it's very clever, actually, is the trap. The trap is just like lasers bouncing off.
Oh, it's very classic Flash trap.
And he's trapped in between these. He's not as fast as lasers.
No.
So he can't get out of it. Abracadabra is disappointed that, you know, it doesn't really fit his motif. Is like, well, it's going to have to do. It's not a magic trick.
Yeah.
It's boring. And then Wally gives him the answer. It's like, well, at least you did it with mirrors. So, yeah, I think it is thematically consistent with your shtick. It's like, oh, yeah. It's like, oh, you saved it for me.
Which is a great take on Wally's relationship with his rogues.
Even though he's not like a rogues gallery.
No, he's never been one of the
but
rogues.
Yeah, but it is. It's like there's a personal relationship there.
They fight because they like each other.
Yeah, it's amusing. So I like that for sure. I like Carlos Pacheco's art here, especially how he does super speed tricks. So you've got like when Impulse runs through a wall, he's surprised to do it. It's like an instinct. He's in a blackness, you know. It's like we've got that perception where there's a blackness while he's phasing through matter, and that's what freaks him out. And then we actually see that. Normally we wouldn't. We see, you know, the Flash decides to take off. And there's like these little panels moment by moment of Linda taking down that antenna on her phone.
Yeah.
We were in 1994. So it's just like, and that, so you see the slow crawl of that moment.
All of a sudden we're in super speed perspective.
Right. For that.
We're living in bullet time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like stuff like that is what makes a good Flash comic to me.
Yeah.
When we feel
the speed.
The speed. And it's not always, I mean, you could, and I mean, plenty of Flash comics don't show that. Don't show anything.
It can be just speed lines.
So in this case, we're actually seeing what it feels like.
Yeah.
What it looks like. Even like tricks that Flash could do that are just mundane. He makes tea and he just rubs the kettle and then the water's hot immediately. You know, because he's rubbing it at super speed. Little details like that. We get a lot. Pacheco likes to go right into the hands doing things.
Well, it's kind of like all of a sudden we're living inside Flash's normal life. I mean, in normal life, why would he use the kettle on the stove? It's going to take forever.
That's right.
You know, so he would just rub it. And you know, I don't know how the Speed Force works, and I don't know why all of a sudden kettle has friction, but air doesn't. But, you know, that's another thing. All of a sudden, we're living inside Flash's everyday mundane life, and even that is fantastic.
So I love these little moments. I think some of them are probably engineered by Mark Waid, who was great at writing super speed. He's great at writing powers. There are a lot of writers that they don't get that necessarily credit for it, but how to write powers. I'm thinking also of like Dan Abnett and Andy Laning who did like the reboot Legion. Okay. Like the Legion Lost and the Legion. Dan Abnett is also like a Doctor Who spin-off fiction writer. I know because I'm, you know, covering these things on the Legion of Super Bloggers right now. A real sense of what the Legionnaires can do with their powers.
See, that's...
Like being, like, how can you take the power that they've got and take it the next level? What are the implications? I think Flash, way back in the 50s and 60s, Flash was all about that. The science hero as designed by Julius Schwartz was, okay, we're using speed, we're using shrinking, like for the atom. What does that mean? What kind of scientific tricks could we apply using scientific or pseudo-scientific concepts?
It became magical when the Speed Force came into action, but
like a mystical, it's the Force.
You can still use
the Flash is a Force baby.
Yeah. Because even afterwards, later on in his career, Wally uses these flashbacks, which are things that Barry used to tell him when he was younger. And that's how I know.
Flashbacks.
That's how I know that Mach 3 is escape velocity. That's how you escape gravity. But I did not know that beforehand. So very scientific.
Yeah. When you look at it, it's like, sometimes the science is dodgy. But it's just like, okay, let's expand from that. If somebody could do such a thing, then what else could they do?
Yeah, they could do a 50-ton punch. Just because he's going fast.
Exactly. You know? So it's thinking about these things. I think that some writers are really, really good at extrapolating.
I think they're having
power
fun.
Tricks.
I think they're having fun with it. Instead of just writing stuff, superheroes doing poweries, the powers are a part of the story. And that's what makes them great storytellers with the powers in mind.
We could also mention Morrison, who even found a way to make Batman smarts the next level. Yeah. What would that mean in superhero terms? So, so this is part of the reason I liked Mark Waid's run on this, because
I always really like it when you say Mark Waid's run on the Flash.
Yeah, run on the Flash. Are we good?
I think we're good.
We'll take a short break, and when we return, your feedback on our previous episode.
Welcome to the world of tomorrow!
The Legion of Superheroes through the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Baxter Series, 5 years later, the Reboot, the Three-Boot, the Retro-Boot, the Animated Series. We have banded together as the Legion of Super Bloggers to cover it all. Seek us out at legionofsuperbloggers.blogspot.com.
Always have to say it that way.
Haven't you ever heard of a little thing called showmanship?
Letters Lost in Time!
Letters Lost in Time!
Our coverage of Superman, the Man of Steel, and Superboy, their tie-ins. This is what your letters look like on social media and at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Early Bird Chris Franklin says, fun show guys, and a fun pair of comics. This was a great era for Superman, mullet aside. Stop saying that. And I loved that Man of Steel issue with all the Batman, because I love identifying different artists on toy packing, licensing art, etc. So I was like a kid in a candy store with that cover, and to a lesser extent, this issue. This particular issue is what I think of when I think of Zero Hour, or at least the tie-ins. Same Chris. I'm not going to lie, Man of Steel was my least favorite of the Superman titles. I either loved what Bogdanov was doing or was strongly revolted by it, sometimes from panel to panel. It was the most out there book of the Triangle era in both art and story. Simonson tended to concentrate on aspects of the storylines I was less interested in, but it was still a solid book with lots of energy. Once the team was gone, I missed them, so there's that. I really dug the clone Superboy right out of the gate. The attitude, the look, the supporting cast, all of it. I kind of hate that Johns pretty much reinvented him in his own angsty image, because he is, from the most part, a totally different character now. I didn't dislike the character, but I sometimes have a hard time reconciling Connor with the Kessel Grummet Superboy. And he says also, this issue is a great mashup of the classic and modern iterations of the character. It reminded me of the Pocket Universe saga that ran in Superman and Legion post-crisis, but with a much happier ending. And honestly, a more classically in-character Kal-El Clark Superboy. I don't think the copyright issues were a real concern at this time, but of course, they were by the mid-2000s, hence Superboy being called Superman on the animated Legion of Superheroes show, and Connor being taken out in Infinity Crisis. Ward Hill Terry says, I really like listening to Bass. He always sounds so happy about everything.
Oh, well, I am. I'm reading comics. What can go wrong?
I'm not going to comment on the books. I'm just listening to you guys and grasping what I can. Sometimes I'm in the dark. Who is Connor? Who is Bibbo? Why would a city still have things like major rock concerts when there has been a widespread destruction of the infrastructure? But I'm going to enjoy the ride. Regarding music tastes of comic book characters, this is something that we talked about because of Superboy. It's like putting a date stamp on a story. From Lois Lane's attraction to Pat Boone, to Ant-Man's naming his aunts Crosby, Stills, and Nash, to Steve Gerber's predilection to showing off eclectic musical taste with his own story titles, the practice of comics writers to inject real pop culture references almost always struck me as pandering or lame. One exception that comes to mind is Captain America. A Roger Stern story showed us that Steve Rogers' record collection is mostly big band music. Cap is from a specific time and place, and that was a clever way of showing it. I recall an interview with Stern where he opined that Peter Parker's possible taste in music was like Elvis Costello and other similar new wave artists. So you can maybe imagine when this was written. I did not agree with Stern, mostly because we never see Peter show any interest in pop music. I figured he was more likely to have been influenced by whatever Aunt May and Uncle Ben would have been listening to, easy listening music, standards, Lawrence Welk, etc. Not shrapnel. In his later series in Detective Comics, Ollie Queen was shown to be a fan of jazz music, and the writer made certain to cite specific artists and albums. And he says, I like fictional bands in comics, like Great Frog and Ape Sex. But yeah, there's no sound in comics.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to, a lot of characters don't have any musical interests because you can't play that.
Music doesn't exist. You have these little graphics, these little notes.
Notes.
But you can't, nobody reads these.
Yeah, so it seems like it's something that a lot of writers forget about. Although, it's also like superhero lives. They're not watching TV and, I mean, if...
Yeah, nobody's going to the bathroom.
No, that's it. It's like,
I mean, it's
except the Beyonder.
Yeah, except the except the Beyonder.
So we know Spider-Man knows how to go to the bathroom because he teaches the Beyonder how to do it. But otherwise...
other than that...
No, Batman doesn't...
No, never seen... I mean, there's no one issue where Batman has the runs.
Yeah, get the t-shirt now. Batman doesn't poop.
On the Fire and Water Network page. Get it now.
David S. Gutierrez says, this was another interesting wind-up to the Greater Zero Hour Mini, but it wasn't one that really nabbed me the way I hoped. This era of Superman is the one I collected the most, but isn't one I ever greedily revisited. That may need changing. Sean Ross says, great show, guys. I'm loving the review of A Really Fun Time in DC. Just the fact that the Jack Knight Starman book launches out of this event makes it all worthwhile, as Starman is, in my humble opinion, the greatest comic of the 90s. Plus, you played some Liz Phair. It inspired me to get drunk, cheat on someone, and burn all my bridges. Still loves her. Michael Bailey writes his usual tirade about you calling Superman's hairstyle a mullet.
It's not a mullet?
I thought about him every time you said it, because I've heard him bitch about this very often. It's just long hair. It's just long hair.
Well, it's a mullet. We see ears.
So if you want to read the tirade, it's on fireandwaterpodcast.com. Otherwise, he
lovely
says...
Mike.
Yeah, he says, Simonson Quarry actually goes back to Superman number 8 by Byrne and Kiesel, famously Bailey's first issue. So this is another story he tells a lot. He says, this is one of my favorite issues of Superman, The Man of Steel, mainly for Bogdanow's homages. Thanks to a friend named Alan and another friend, some guy named Shag, I managed to get two copies of that promo poster that has the Superman surrounded by Batman on one side and Batman surrounded by Superman on the other. It was a fun issue and everything a crossover issue should be. I love this era of Superboy. The character was never better than when handled by Kiesel and Grummet. The sad bastard Connor was interesting, but the retcon that Luthor was half his DNA did nothing but provide unnecessary angst to what was supposed to be a fun character. Yeah, his original costume was dated almost from the start, and yes, the t-shirt and jeans look is more timeless, but after Johns got his hands on the character, he was never the same. Your mileage may vary.
I think there's, people grow up as well.
Yeah. I don't think the Titans level characters should be the same personality forever.
No, yeah.
Let's not forget, we just covered Wally West. Exactly. Last time we talked about Wally West on the other show.
He was Whiny Wally.
Whiny Wally.
And I didn't like
Whiny Wally. A completely different character from where, yeah. But you can track it. So yeah. maybe you can't track the Kiesel Grummet Superboy, you know, reaching the point where he is T-shirt Superboy. I don't know.
Maybe
that's the problem.
Maybe that was a soft reboot. Also, I mean, it felt like a soft reboot.
Well, Zero Hour's coming.
Well, yeah.
No, actually, he stays Kiesel Grummet Superboy for a while. It's not there.
I think going the angst route is maybe more interesting if you're writing stories. I don't know. Angst is always a good motivator for bad decisions. You know.
But then so is impulsive youth. You're writing to an audience that you think exists.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of angsty teenagers who might be reading comics. You're writing to them. Now, this is probably the success of X-Men, which was very angsty, or the 90s, which were very angsty.
Yeah.
Kids were just angsty, as a rule.
And, I mean, they're angsty now.
Yeah. I feel like as an older reader, I like the fun-loving heroes, but maybe as a teenager, I might have liked the angsty heroes better. So well, who are you relating this for?
You can relate, right? When you're angsty, you relate to angsty.
And yeah.
That's why everybody loved Spider-Man. Can't get any angstier than Spider-Man. My
yeah.
God.
Yeah, exactly.
He had this inner monologue for 25 pages. He said two jokes were just to cover up his own angst all the time. And everybody loved Spider-Man. I mean, he was... So everybody's yeah. Everybody's trying to do Spider-Man.
Everybody's doing Spider-Man.
So yeah.
That's what it is. Also got Diablo Franks, excerpts from Diablo Franks chapter of this saga. He says, Superman the Man of Steel debuted on May 14th, 1991, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. DC did such an amazing job of promoting the launch that I don't think I was aware the title existed until War of the Gods 2 months later. And I believe that it went something like, what the hell is this to me? It remained the weird one with the terrible villains and the funky art that I probably didn't even bother to flip through until purchasing the first Reign of the Superman tie-in issue number 22. I was immediately hooked by the introduction of John Henry Irons, and he was easily my favorite of the replacement Superman. Hear, hear. Unintentional fate praise, since I don't like any of the other Supermen, but I really liked Iron John as he was initially, unfortunately, dubbed on an early cover. Speaking from both recent and long-term experience, a lot of comic artists have an aversion to drawing black people, and many are really bad at it. John Bogdanow, on the other hand, excels, and with Louise Simonson, created one of the best under-heralded mainstream superheroes of color. In retrospect, Bogdanow was doing most of the heavy lifting because his renditions of Irons and his neighborhood conveyed more humanity and depth than the actual scripts ultimately afforded them. Irons' nascent narrative was swiftly subsumed by the larger multi-title story arc, and Bogdanow did not choose to draw the Steel spinoff series. So that's enough about that until we actually cover Steel. There is a tie-in issue of Steel.
Yeah, I love Steel. I can't wait for that.
You may want to wait. I don't think that Steel really... The Steel series...
He was my favorite from the Superman.
The Reign.
I really did enjoy him. I liked everything about Steel. I liked that he's a new take on a folk hero. He has this incredible weapon. I would have liked to see him, you know, being upped, going the next level.
They did include him in the JLA.
Oh, yeah.
Morrison put him in the JLA. His own series did not have... I think it really is a matter of the art. It didn't have that, like, powerful art that his run in during Reign of the Superman did. Let's keep on with Frank. He says, of the four titles, I enjoyed Man of Steel the most. Simonson had the humanistic leanings needed for Clark Kent and the most authentic handling of Lois Lane investigative journalist. Bogdanow was the clear successor to the cartoonish vigor of Joe Shuster, as well as the barrel-chested glory of Wayne Boring during the peak of the hero's popularity and cultural impact. That said, long-haired Superman was perhaps the most pointedly off-model under Bogdanow. I tried to continue with Man of Steel briefly on its own, but the interconnectivity of the Triangle period made following Superman an all-or-nothing proposition, so I chose nothing. I did buy Superman the Man of Steel number 37, just to marvel at Bogdanow's versatility at applying so many other artists' styles. It was a fun and successful experiment. As for Superboy, hearing that Superboy had good taste in 90s indie chick rockers just makes me suspect him more. Was he playing it up to get under Tana Moon's skirt? Was it the first stuff he was exposed to out of the vat? He's way more into Whip Smart than Exile in Guyville, and he probably just saw the videos for Supernova and Down by the Water and went swing! Connell's a creeper. I'm pretty sure I bought Superboy number 8 for the dueling incarnations, read it once, stuffed it in a long box, and forgot about it until my next purge. I pretty much hated the Metropolis Kid's poochy ass on sight. From his snow sunglasses to his Vanilla Ice shave to his Jake Hansen leather jacket to his Jim Lee pointless leg belts and his overall Brian Austin greenness, he fairly screamed what middle-aged comic nerds think is a cool dude. But I suspect to most he was clearly Super Fuckboy from Jump. That said, I've read enough classic Con-El material to recognize Kiesel and Grummet were basically doing an extended, extensive riff on Kirby in general and his Jimmy Olsen run in particular. There's a lot of Cadness stuff eventually, including Double X, even in the issue we covered, you know. Mm-hmm. Which, coupled with the Rain momentum, pushed his solo to a respectable centennial run. High fives, Firestorm, while Aquaman's salty tears float into his also not a mullet, henceforth Alamis, or perhaps a Fabio. So, of course, DC ran screaming from the interpretation that carried all those issues in favor of Emo Clone. See also Impulse. So, you know, it's like, this hero's successful. Let's throw it all out. You know, each generation has to have their own take.
That's fine.
It's fine. Max Travers says, I specifically remember this Superboy issue as one of my favorites. Unlike some, I was really enjoying the post-death of Superman Superboy title very much. And it was a treat to see these two very different takes on the character. Or at least the character name contrasted with each other. Max says, unlike some. I guess.
I didn't really like Superboy. I thought, I'm going to be agreeing with Diablo Frank.
Okay.
I always thought as Superboy, that era Superboy, as a poser. He was like this guy trying to be cool, and he was not. As soon as you're trying to be cool, when you put your sunglasses inside the house, you're automatically not cool anymore.
Okay, yeah.
Because if you're doing it to be cool, it's not working. That's not how it works. You can't be cool. Cool is something that's given to you, and you can't take it. You're either, people say you're cool, you can't say you're cool. And if you do it, you're uncool. That's how it works. That's the dynamics of that. And I always thought as this era Superboy was just, you know, trying to be cool. He was a fashion disaster. He had belts on his leg. Are you bleeding to death? Why do you have a belt on your leg?
Yeah, tourniquet.
Do you have a holster? Carrying a gun? Packing heat? What?
You know, just a knife. Just like a slip of knife in there.
Yeah, so I always thought of him as kind of a poser. You know, he's trying to be cool, hanging out with chicks.
But I think that is the character.
And
I think the comic knew it. Because he had like, yeah. Like his terror in this thing was the dog. The dog was sort of peeing in the whiz wagon, which is aptly named. He could not control that dog. It's a very small little terrier. And it's like it drove him mad. And then the entire supporting cast, it's like he's got like that agent, and it's like, you know, your life is completely out of control, Mr. Cool. So I think the comic knew it and kept,
okay,
you know, and kept pooping on him and kept saying, you're not as cool as you think. You're not as cool as you think. And it's about that hero growing up some, because like Impulse, it's like he's fully formed. He's a teenager.
He woke up,
he was already a teenager. So Impulse is similar. It's like 2 years old.
Yeah.
He has no idea what's going, you know, what life is like.
And maybe having that pummeled into him, you know, you're not that cool, sir. Well, he started,
he angst him up.
Angst him up. And then he looks at Superman. I mean, if I'm just riffing on the
Young Justice.
Yeah. He looks at Superman and he's like, you know what? You're not that cool, Superman, with your bright clothes. You're not that cool. Maybe it is kind of a trackable.
Mm, okay.
I'm getting into that trackable thing.
All right, cool. Martin Gray says, thanks for a great episode. I enjoyed both these issues. John Bogdanow's commitment to the Zero Hour story was astonishing, and Simonson gave him the perfect canvas. I love stories in which different versions of characters meet one another. Superboy Prime accepted after his first appearance. I will never understand why Carl Kiesel isn't allowed to write any book he wants at DC or Marvel. How many brilliant FF fill-ins does he have to produce before being given a shot as regular writer? And his Superboy artistic partner, Tom Grummett, is similarly underrated. Together, they produce pure superhero joy. Completely agree with this. Tim Price says, I was collecting all of the Superman titles at this time, and I love this Man of Steel issue, but oddly, on reread, I can't recall anything about the other subplots that were touched upon. You know, like the vampire band. And
yeah.
I'm at a loss, don't get me wrong. Big fan of Louise and John, but it must not have stuck as well. But this issue, wow, Bogdanov captured so many artistic styles. That was the best part, absolutely. But I have to give props to Wheezy for capturing the various Batman characters in her dialogue. Anyone else notice the old friend mention? And the colorist, Glenn Whitmore, also had to work overtime to make the Batman's look right. Fantastic effort all around. Superboy was definitely a favorite of mine. Kiesel and Grummett are magical together, and I'm glad to see them still collaborating today on Section Zero. That bit with the music store woman is one of their hallmarks. Every character gets to be a person, no matter how brief their appearance. I think it's part of Kiesel's approach. Make everybody interesting, and maybe some will click and return. But if they don't, at least it's more fun to write and read. As for the boy's musical taste, we'll see it in about 4 years. That he likes garbage. The group, not the quality. And there's a continuing trend. I always thought Hypertime was created by Mark Waid, as its first appearance is actually in the series The Kingdom. But looking it up, one source credits it to both Waid and Morrison. Interesting. Same. I'm not sure who started it. It feels, I credited Morrison because it feels like a Morrison idea.
Mm-hmm.
But then Mark Waid is also a thinker of comics and comic worlds.
Yeah.
They seem to have collaborated on it.
Hey.
Maybe both used it. I don't know.
I like them both. They can both be credited for all I care. Hypertime.
Bradleyman says, this is one of my favorite Superboy stories. Not quite as much love for the Superman story. I wanted a multiverse where the Superboys could team up because of this issue. I think this was the problem for me with the way things eventually end up. The series makes the multiverse look cool, then doesn't give us the multiverse. That's a good point.
It is a good point.
Because it's like we're doing Crisis without Crisis. We're doing a multiverse. We're doing alternate worlds histories. And then the end product, it's a one-shot deal. We're not going to...
It's not that.
The DC Universe does not do this again for years.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird teaser. I can understand, yeah, why somebody would be like, ooh, this is going to be fun crossovers, and they don't become fun crossovers.
No. Well, Crisis was in 86, so like 8 years. I don't think that's enough time to say, oh, let's scrap the one universe. And it would use the one universe to good effect through the 90s. I think, you know, for me, the whole legacy and JSA history and all of that stuff that will come up, Starman
yeah.
being one example that's going to come up.
The one and only omnibus I have.
Is the Starman one?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Love that. I love that. I discovered it, suggested by René, who is the guy who works at the Comic Hunter comic shop here. And I was looking for something that he knows me. And he went, you know what? You should grab this. And I grabbed it and never let it go. It was wonderful.
There you go. So we'll get to talk about Starman later in the show. We also get some nice notices on Facebook from Michael O'Brien, Joe Tipton, Rick Sharp, and Brad Glynn. Thanks, guys. Before we go, we have to mention that Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page. So if you like our content, please think about making a one-time or monthly donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. So get on the zero list at patreon.com/FW podcasts. Reminder as well that you can leave us comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also follow our Facebook page or on Twitter. The account is FW podcasts.
Well, you said that quickly.
I've gotten used to it. I say it weekly.
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 Next time on Zero Hour Strikes, finally, Zero Hour number 4.